This is a special edition of Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the premier financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Now, for this special edition of Macro Voices, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Macro Voices All-Stars episode number 24 was recorded on July 1st, 2019. I'm Eric Townsend. All-Star Professor Steve Keen is back with us this week for another update, and Steve has prepared a PDF download which includes a number of tables that we'll be referring to throughout this interview. You can find the download links on our homepage at macrovoices.com right next to Steve's picture. Steve, you are one of maybe a dozen economists who have been credited with seeing the 2008 crisis coming and accurately describing why it was coming and what was about to happen. What did you and the other 11 people who were able to see this coming know that tens of thousands of others seem to have missed?
Actually, it reminded me of the old statement by, I think it was Mark Twain, saying that isn't what you don't know that kills you, it's what you know for sure that's wrong. And I think that's really answers why the rest of the profession missed it, because the rest of them know that credit plays no role in aggregate demand, because credit is simply a transfer of spending power from person A to person B. And when the loan is made, person B who gets the loan can spend more. When it's repaid, person A can spend more. And it's like a seesaw. The actual amount of spending power just is like the middle of the fulcrum of the seesaw. It doesn't change. It's allocated from one person to another. And that is a profound insight, which is profoundly wrong. And by being led by that insight, people like Bernanke and Krugman and the whole conventional Todd Geithner, Paulson, everybody you care to name, Summers, et cetera, completely ignored credit in the run-up to the financial crisis. When people like myself who did not know that, who believed that credit was part of aggregate demand somehow, even though some of us hadn't worked out precisely just how it fitted in, we were looking at the level of private debt, looking at the rate of change of private debt, which is what I define credit as. Credit is a new loan. So credit is the rate of change of the outstanding level of debt. And by looking at that, I saw a massive level of private debt in America, 1.5 times GDP, not long before the crisis began. Incredible rate of increase in that debt. So credit was equivalent to 15% of GDP at the peak. I said this simply can't go on. When it stops, credit will go from being a positive to aggregate demand to a negative. And when that happens, there'll be a slump. And that's what I was warning about before the crisis happened. Of course, that's what actually happened.
Steve, this doesn't seem that difficult to comprehend to me. Who's able to spend more money? The guy who's got no money but does have $100,000 of available credit on his credit card, or the guy who's got no money and doesn't have any credit because he can't get credit? Economists think of them the same way. Help me. Why don't they worry about the level of debt and credit in the economy in all these equations then?
It's because they have a model. And anybody who starts telling you what they think about the economy is normally explaining what their model says the economy does. And the model they have is called loanable funds. And if you take a look on the page of the New York Times and read Paul Krugman, you'll get, you know, a heavy diet of loanable funds. And loanable funds quite literally describes as when the economy is, when the level of debt's increasing, it's not a case of people borrowing more money. It's a case of patient people lending to impatient people. And that's the mental model they have. So they actually see banks as what they call intermediaries. They talk about financial intermediation and financial intermediaries, transferring spending power from one person to another, not creating new spending power by creating new debt and creating a new liability at the same time, which is exactly what banks actually do. So they have a model which blinds them to what you and I just automatically think. Of course, somebody takes out a credit card and they've got headroom in their credit card. They get more spending power than somebody who hasn't. And the spending power comes from the bank creating debt. It doesn't come from a transfer of spending power from one existing customer of the bank to another customer.
Okay, Steve, is there some way to stop these headless chicken arguments then? Is there a definitive proof that credit either matters or doesn't matter?
Yeah, and it's extremely simple. This is, I must say, it took me a long time to work out what's an incredibly simple explanation. But the basic idea is that the reason that a lot of people, and not just conventional economists, also quite a few unconventional economists, even people in modern monetary theory, haven't worked this one out yet, is that there's a rule of in macroeconomics that expenditure is income. So if I spent, you know, $100 buying your microphone off you, if you were selling microphones, then my expenditure of $100 is your income of $100. They're precisely equal. And at the individual level, you can have a gap between what you spend and what you get back. You can spend more money on other people than they spend on you, so you have a deficit. They can spend more than you do on them, so you have a surplus. But at the aggregate level, when you add up the entire economy, expenditure is identical to income. And people said, unless I can prove that credit plays a role while having expenditure equal to income, then I can't prove anything at all. And I finally thought, well, you're dead right. I should be able to prove it by dreaming up a way of a logical construct that shows expenditure is income, and then showing out of that that credit is part of aggregate demand. So if I can take the readers through the documents I hope they're looking at, if they're not, I've got to get their imaginations working and say, imagine you divide the economy into three sectors, sector one, two, three. They could be anything, government, non-government, foreign. They could be consumption, investment, services. It doesn't matter. Just three sectors. And sector one spends on sector two and three. Sector two spends on sector one and three. Sector three spends on sector one and two. And you can lay this out in a table where each row is expenditure. So if I look at sector one's expenditure, it will be spending A dollars per year on sector two and B dollars per year on sector three. And if I draw this up and have the first cell in this table is minus A minus B coming out of sector one's bank account and plus A and plus B going into sector two and sector three's account. So the sum of the whole row is minus A minus B for sector one plus A plus B for sector two and three. It sums to zero, and that's absolutely a given. And then for the next sector, I've got sector two spending C dollars on sector one and D dollars on sector three per year. That also sums to zero. And then I've got sector three spending E dollars per year in sector one and F dollars per year on sector two. That also sums to zero. Now, what it means if I just take one of those, and I know this is going to be complicated for anybody who hasn't got the table in front of them, but sector one is going to be spending A plus B and receiving C plus E, there can be a difference. So you look down vertically, you can have more income than expenditure at an individual sector or the other way around, but in the aggregate, the whole thing adds to zero. And I call this a Moore table in honor of Basil Moore, who first invented the modern concept of endogenous money creation by banks. So that's looking at a world where there's no money, creation, pardon me, there's a fixed amount of money, there's no banking and there's no lending. And in that world, aggregate demand is A plus B plus C plus D plus E plus F, and aggregate expenditure exactly the same thing. So that's the idea of a Moore table. Then I bring in the idea of what if the lending happens, and I look at the model that Krugman has, which is banks don't actually originate money. They act like an Ashley Madison introduction service, and they introduce you to somebody else who wants to lend you money and will charge you interest for the privilege of doing it. So in that case, sector two is lending credit dollars per year to sector one, and then sector one is spending credit dollars per year on sector three. And when you look at it and work out what is the total level of income and expenditure in the economy, credit cancels out, disappears out of the equation. Something else turns up, but I'll leave the people looking at the table to work out how gross financial transactions become part of expenditure. Now, that's the mythical model that people like Krugman and Bernanke have in their heads, that banks are just introduction agency, that don't actually originate debt. The real world, which thank God the Bank of England and the Bundesbank and the Norwegian Central Bank and even the Australian Central Bank have come out and said is the way things actually happen, is that banks originate money and debt. So when you get a credit card, when you access your credit card through a bank, the bank records the additional credit as an increase in its assets, and that credit becomes an increase in its liabilities as well, which is money you spend and you can spend on somebody else. So in that situation, the credit is created by the bank giving you a loan. You have this additional money in your bank account. You spend it on another sector, and credit does not net out. The credit that is created by the bank giving you that loan is an addition to aggregate expenditure because you spend the money, and it's spent on, in the case I've got sector one spending the money on sector three, it's additional spending by sector one, which is expenditure, it's additional income by sector three, which is income, they're necessarily equal to the two. And when you look at credit is part of aggregate demand and aggregate income. And it might sound complicated verbally, but if people look at the tables we've linked to, it's just that simple. So in that case, Credit is part of aggregate demand, and if your model tells you to ignore credit, you're ignoring the most volatile part of aggregate demand. You won't see anything coming until it smashed you unconscious.
And again, for the benefit of any listeners whose heads may be spinning from Sector 1, 2, and 3, this is all in a table in a PDF download, which is available from our website at macrovoices.com. Just look for the link next to Steve's picture on the website. Steve, final question. You've taken something that was already intuitively clear to me, frankly, and you've laid out a formal definition that seems incredibly compelling and persuasive, like there's no room left for anybody to doubt that credit adds to aggregate demand. But economists are special creatures. Do you think they're going to give way and include credit in their macroeconomic models now? I mean, it seems pretty darn clear.
Yeah, they won't. They simply won't. This is where ideology is such an important part of economics, unfortunately, because this is just simple realism. I'm not being left or right and saying this. I'm simply looking at accounting tables and seeing what pops out. But because this means that as neoconventional economists would have to suddenly start taking banks' debt and money seriously and including it in their models, because it also gives you a non-equilibrium outcome because the credit boosts demand above what it would be with just turnover circulation of money, reduces it at other times. It's something they simply don't want to think about. So they just basically ignore it. And that's ironic when you look at the data again, because just as it's intuitively obvious to you, it's screamingly obvious when you look at the data. So in that particular document, I've included two charts. One showing the level of private debt in America compared to as a percentage of GDP, which is the level of debt, and the rate of change of that debt, which is credit. And if you look at it, between 1945 and 2008, credit was positive, never went negative. Then you get 2008 coming along, it goes from plus 15% of GDP to minus 5%. And that's when the financial crisis occurred. In the next chart, I then show credit and I graph it against the unemployment rate. And I don't know how many of your listeners are old enough to remember Rorschach plots. You know, the old idea of the psychologist showing you a blotter and asking, what does it make you think of? Everybody thinks of sex when they look at a Rorschach plot. But nonetheless, when you look at the chart of credit versus unemployment, it virtually looks like a Rorschach plot. And the correlation coefficient between the two is minus 0.85 between 1990 and today. It's overwhelmingly in the data, and the conventional economists will continue ignoring it, which means if you want to go and make money in the market, play against the economists, do what Ray Dalio does, look at credit, and this is why you'll make a killing, because anybody who's done an economics degree is going to be stupid enough to ignore what you can see that's blindingly obvious in the data.
Well, Steve, I am utterly shocked to learn that you see sex in those ink blots. I was certain that you were going to say you saw that famous crossing of the supply and demand curves in those ink blots. Mm-hmm. I know that's what really turns you on. Well, I can't thank you enough, Steve, for another fantastic interview. We look forward to getting another update in a couple of weeks. For the Macro Voices Podcast Network, I'm Eric Townsend.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Please register your free account at macrovoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly research roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts, Eric Townsend, shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices.